This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's one of the first questions in our phone or FaceTime conversations. How are you doing? And what we usually mean by it right now anyway is not, do you have the virus, but how are you? How are you coping? How are you surviving these strategies we've developed to not get the virus or spread the virus? Because it's weird staying in and staying apart. You've probably seen some version of this saying lately. Someone retweeted it or posted it on Instagram or something. Your grandparents were called to war. You're being asked to sit on the couch. You can do this. And yes, of course we can. And yes, it's silly that this is being perceived as some great struggle. But the truth is, social isolation really is difficult because we're social creatures. So that is what we're going to talk about today. What are the real impacts of social isolation and loneliness? How are your relationships with the people who are there with you at home? If you live alone, how are you handling all of this isolation? What has been the most challenging part of being home, if you are at home? And if you're still going to work, do you feel safe? You can call us at 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. We'll take your calls in about 15 minutes, so please join us. First, though, we thought it might make sense to explain the reason humans are social creatures and the impact of loneliness on the body. Earlier this morning, we spoke with Dr. Julianne Holt-Lunstad. She's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University. And her specialty, I think you could call it that, her specialty is loneliness. She researches the impact of social isolation, of living alone, of loneliness. And one of the things she told us is that for humans, being alone all the time is not natural.
Across a number of scientific disciplines, it's argued that humans are social species. And this is the idea that throughout human history, we've needed to rely upon others for survival. Whether it was, you know, protection from the elements or predators, or simply, you know, the efficiency of pooling of resources, that we really needed to be part of a group, and that our brains have adapted to really expect others and the presence of others. And so that when we do not have proximity to others, and particularly trusted others, that this leads to heightened alertness and greater utilization of metabolic resources in our brains and body to have to, in essence, deal with our world on our own.
So this resistance that we're seeing from everyone, really, to being having to socially distance, that isn't just our sense of boredom or ambivalence or a sense of irresponsibility. It's an actual biological impulse. We are basically programmed to resist social isolation, I guess.
Yeah. In fact, neuroscientists have argued that loneliness is a biological drive, much like hunger and thirst. So just like hunger is this biological drive to motivate you to seek out food and thirst to seek out water, that loneliness is a biological drive that motivates us to seek out others, to reconnect, to rejoin the group, because that's adaptive.
So we are social creatures, but you have also talked about how we're all on a continuum of being, in some cases, really connected, in some cases, being disconnected. Sometimes we do feel lonely, that we're kind of all over the place at times.
Right. So I think there is often the misconception that people are either lonely or not. And of course, there's a large degree of stigma and shame around loneliness. People don't want to admit they're lonely because it somehow has this stigma of being a social failure. But in reality, we all feel lonely from time to time. Some people feel it more on a chronic basis. But as you said, our research shows that the effects of this on long-term health outcomes is on a continuum. So we're all somewhere on that continuum, and this really applies to us all.
What's the difference between isolation and loneliness? Because we think of them as the same thing, but you say they're kind of different.
Yes, they are. And people often use the terms interchangeably, and I think that's because they often can go hand in hand. So social isolation is much more objective. It's really thought of as having few relationships or infrequent social contact, whereas loneliness is a more of a subjective feeling, or feeling alone rather than actually objectively being alone. And so loneliness is defined as the discrepancy between one's actual and one's desired level for social connection. And of course, being alone increases your likelihood that you're going to feel alone.
Yeah, yeah.
But you certainly can be socially isolated, so you can be alone and not feel lonely. You might take great pleasure in that solitude. And conversely, you may feel lonely despite being around others. Many of us have heard the term lonely in a crowd.
Right.
This idea that we can be surrounded by others and yet still feel a sense of disconnection or profoundly lonely.
So let's talk about how this manifests itself. Isolation or loneliness, actually, let's sort of key in on that one, how that manifests itself in our bodies, like the physiological effect. So you, among some of the other work that you've done, is you did this analysis of this collection of studies. I think it was like 70 of them. This was back in 2015. A lot of people, like more than 3 million people. What did this tell us about how loneliness is affecting us physiologically?
Yeah, so what we did was we compiled the data across all these studies from around the world. And this data was collected by following people over time to see whether social isolation, loneliness, or living alone significantly predicted risk for premature mortality. So following people over time to see how long they would live. And what we found was that loneliness predicted a 26% increase likelihood of earlier death, social isolation, a 29% increase likelihood of earlier death, and living alone, 32%. And of course, we made sure that these were independent of other kinds of factors that we already know predict earlier death, like age and initial health status, and a number of lifestyle factors. So these were independent risk factors for premature mortality.
So there's this ironic effect I wanted to ask you about of this social isolation caused by this virus. There's an effect on our immune system.
Yeah. Some work out of Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh did some really incredible studies looking at the common cold. And what they did is, after exposing their participants to the common cold, what they found was that those who were more stressed, or experiencing more stress, were not only more likely to develop a cold, but had more severity of symptoms. But those who had more diverse social networks were less likely to develop a cold. And so there seems to be some kind of effect on immune functioning that is going on there as well.
Do you think, Professor, it could be too early for us to be talking about loneliness in this condition? I mean, and you know, are we overstating it a bit? I mean, we haven't been socially distancing all that long. It's not like most of us don't see our neighbors or others on walks and hikes and those kinds of things. Is it too early to say we're lonely because of the coronavirus?
Well, I don't think it's too early, because I think part of what you bring up is it's relevant in the sense of many people are feeling either resistance to following the recommendations of social distancing, which is something that, you know, we critically need right now, because that is an immediate threat that we need to deal with. But many people are feeling incredibly distressed during this time. So everything's very uncertain. And one of the ways in which social relationships can have such an important impact on these health outcomes is through social support during times of stress. And so during this, you know, we need people more than ever, and yet we're, of course, being recommended. And of course, we should follow those recommendations to mitigate this critical immediate risk.
I wanted to ask you about another bit of research that's been done that shows giving support has stronger benefits even than receiving support. Talk a little bit about that, because it seems like one way to maybe combat the sense of loneliness or helplessness is to reach out and support someone else, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So in this area of social support, there's been a lot of interest in terms of perceptions or receiving. And one interesting finding is that there seemed to be this greater benefit associated with providing support, even more so than receiving support. And I think what that suggests is currently in this time, and at any time for that matter, that by reaching out to others, checking in on them, seeing how they're doing, that can not only help them, but it can really help yourself through this situation.
Back in 2011, your husband was diagnosed with cancer. You were a working mother, and you've talked about how you described it as an eye-opener for you, how hard it was to accept support, how hard it was, difficult it was to be dependent on others. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, because I think a lot of people are resisting this idea of having to depend on others, and it seems like that's baked into our culture, that we perceive needing others as some kind of weakness in some way.
You know, I think our culture values independence, and that to be a functioning adult means to be independent and to not have to rely on others. And so, you know, here I was facing this really difficult situation where I desperately needed help. My husband was hospitalized for approximately 4 months.
Wow.
And my children were 4 and 8 at the time, and still trying to work. And it was really a difficult time. And I had wonderful friends and family and neighbors who were so wonderful. But I found myself, even despite the fact that my research is on you know, social support and how this can all help, I had a very hard time accepting it, even when offered, because I didn't want to be a burden to other people, right? And I was afraid that if I was a burden on them, that would strain our relationship in some way, which, you know, in retrospect, it feels silly, because I've since seen others who are going through similar situations, and from an outside, you know, others really, truly, genuinely want to help. And so allowing others that opportunity to help helps them feel that they can do something as well. And so I feel like in this situation, we need to be more open and receptive to the idea that we're not necessarily dependent on others, but we're interdependent. We really need to rely on others. And certainly in our current pandemic situation, you know, we're all in this together, and we're going to need to rely on each other during this tough time.
You've also mentioned that there might be a danger that after the pandemic passes, once it ends, people may remain isolated. I think you've described it as a social recession.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm a health psychologist, and one of the things that we look at is habits and how habits can be difficult to form, but once they're broken, you know, new habits can easily take their place. And I worry that as we try to adjust to our new situation, and we're all trying to find this new sense of normal, that we will continue distancing ourselves from others beyond this immediate threat. I'm also reminded of other kinds of situations where, for instance, in municipalities where the public water became contaminated, and yet despite after the problem was fixed, local residents still didn't trust the water. And I worry that we will come to a point where we no longer, you know, trust, and that in a way of protecting ourselves, that we continue to do this, and that this will really occur beyond the point at which we really need to. And, you know, the idea that if it's not this virus, it's another one. I've already seen article headlines of how architects are considering designing the physical built environment in light of COVID-19. And what that might suggest is that there may be efforts to distance people, you know, in our physical environment beyond this. But on the other hand, I'm also incredibly optimistic, because I also see some really wonderful examples of how people are coming together and the recognition of just how important our relationships are. And so I hope that there can be some real good that comes from this as well.
I guess it brings us finally back to what we were talking about earlier, that loneliness may be a biological drive, like hunger or thirst. What people are feeling then, right now, is deeply natural. And I guess we shouldn't ignore those impulses. You know, if we're programmed to feel this way, like thirst motivates you to seek out water, loneliness motivates you to seek out connection. So try and find that connection, even if it's difficult, and even if we have to do it at a distance, I guess.
Yes. While we are remaining physically distant, remain socially connected.
Dr. Julianne Holt-Lundstedt, she's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
As a yoga teacher, Jesmyn Stanley is well aware that much of yoga culture in the U.S. can be a little tone deaf.
Trying to understand the difference between appreciation and appropriation helps me find my own footing.
This week on Preach, the author of Everybody Yoga, on how yoga became her spiritual practice, and being brave enough to share your unfiltered self on Instagram. Find Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today we're talking about how we're all feeling, our mental health, in this time of isolation and uncertainty. And maybe you've been irritable. Maybe you've been short with the kids or your partner. Maybe you just can't seem to get anything done, either because you can't focus or just because you're feeling totally overwhelmed. Well, our next guest, Kristen Hodson, like our previous guest, says all of this is natural, even normal. Hodson is a clinical social worker, the founder and executive director of the mental health clinic, The Healing Group. She's going to join us for the rest of the hour today. Kristen Hodson, welcome to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
She's joining us by phone, as you can tell. We're keeping our distance, as we have been lately on this show. So, Kristen Hodson, I'm assuming you're busy. Is that a fair assumption? As a therapist, you're busy.
We're busy, and we're busy in non-traditional ways. We're seeing a lot of people connect in ways that they're able. That our offices have completely shut down, and we've moved to teletherapy. And so we've had to also connect in ways that would be atypical in the mental health norms. We're having to go through kind of a decision tree of, okay, if we can't meet in this way, we'll go to this method. And if we can't meet in that way, we'll go to the phone, so that we can attend to people in these really uncertain times.
Were you surprised at all how quickly this seemed to be affecting people? I mean, you'd think we'd be able to do this for a few weeks without having these emotional impacts, but it seemed to set in pretty quickly.
Right. And I think Utah was positioned in a really unique way, because as the coronavirus was starting to avalanche and unfold, then we were hit with an earthquake.
Right.
And I think it really increased people's anxiety, and people are on high alert looking for their next metaphorical tremor and what's going to be happening tomorrow, because something entirely new that wasn't on our radar was introduced. And I think that puts people into an increased state of heightened arousal.
I want to get to the phone calls as soon as we can. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. Let's talk to Taylor, who's joining us in Bountiful. Taylor, hi.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I've always been told that I have a face for radio, so I'm excited to try this out.
Go for it.
So for me, I'm a local in Salt Lake. I work for a 115-year-old family business that's been a staple of downtown for a long time, and it's been interesting talking to the fifth generation family owners who, through the Great Depression, through all of these different ups and downs, they've never had to shut business down completely ever. And we made the decision last Tuesday to close our doors to try to curb the pandemic like everybody else has, and so that's put about 20 employees at home. And for us, we're in a unique spot because we're such a social store. We have so much one-on-one interaction with people that it just doesn't make sense for us to keep our doors open. And so going from such a social environment every day, being around people from not only all over the state, but all over the world, to just, like, you know, radio silence at home has been kind of unique. But for us, for me personally, it's been unique. I have three kids, twins that are five, and an almost two-year-old daughter. And it's been kind of fun to spend 10 days with them. I think my wife has inherited another five-year-old. We've been building forts and playing board games and trying to put out fires. And I feel like it's my responsibility to be like the life is beautiful dad and kind of create this world where our kids don't have to be so on edge about what's going on. And you know, if there's a little tremor from the earthquake, we try to play it off like it's something fun, so our kids don't have to be worried all the time of what's going on, and my wife and I can be the ones that try to brave that sort of impact.
Kristen Hansen, what are you hearing there? That parents have to be the stalwarts, or that there may be one partner who's playing the creative role and one who's playing the other? I mean, I can hear a lot of interesting creative solutions in that with Taylor, but I'm wondering if it also reveals how this dynamic is settling in, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm hearing a lot of marital ingenuity and relational creativity, because what really starts to happen as our traditional ways that we connect and engage are closed off, we find new ways. And I think we're also inherently sensing that the way people are coping with what's going on is different. We're all handling it in different ways. And as we see, maybe our partner is having a rougher day, or they're more tired, then we tend to then pick it up in a different way. And this is a really unique time when not a single person, everyone is impacted by what's going on. There's not one singular person or entity that can hold all of this for everybody. And so I hear within these families, they're coming up with their own rhythm and pace of how they're handling this.
Taylor, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, again, the number. Back to the phones. Francis is with us in Salt Lake City. Francis, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, we are dealing in our house with what I have started to call pandemic guilt. I think there is an idea being perpetuated that we are in a unique circumstance and somehow we need to be, quote unquote, making the most of the pandemic. Hmm. And I think it is a coping strategy, but when you say it out loud, it starts to seem kind of insane. But I think there is this pressure to, right now is the time to get all your home improvement projects done, or deep clean a room, organize your pantry. Or on the flip side, this idea that just this now is a really valuable time to take a step back from everything and soak in this precious time with your family and spend your days playing board games and watching movies. And in our experience, anyway, neither of those things is even remotely
realistic. Yeah. We have a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 3-year-old home from school. My husband and I are both trying to work from home and balancing our own work needs and schedules. And every day is really an exercise in survival. But now with this added layer on top of it of feeling badly that we're somehow not doing the pandemic right.
Right. Man, we can't win with this thing. Kristen, I wanted to, a couple of things that I wanted to tease out in Frances's call. One is just, we'll talk a little bit about that pandemic guilt that she's talking about, that we're all looking for something useful to do with this time, or we're trying to be, you know, we're trying to drop all of the frenzy and do something else. How should we be sort of approaching this? Because as Frances said, neither of those are working for them.
Right. And I really like your word should, that there is this idea of how we should be going through a pandemic. And the reality is there's not a playbook that exists on how anyone should be getting through this. And that right now, most people are just surviving. I know a lot of parents are having to wake up early before the kids start their day to try to get work in, because then they're doing a work school hustle throughout the day. And then they're working when the kids go to bed because they've got to get a little bit more in, or they don't have the energy. Like, people are barely like, I can get dressed at 1 o'clock. And right now isn't, if you have a day where you can get some extra things done, great. But this really isn't a time to write a new novel or to get all the things done that you've put on the shelf. It's, we are carrying a lot of energy. I think about phones and all the apps that are going on in the background. That absorbs energy. Having what's going on in the background absorbs energy, but it's an invisible, it's taking up space in an invisible way. We can't visually see it, so it's hard to comprehend and really internalize the ginormous impact this is having on our emotions.
Talk a little bit about her. She's talking about how she and her husband are trying to sort of cope with the kids. And one of the things you've talked about is that we need to, you're recommending to couples that they revisit their agreements and that you need to identify these new rules for these new circumstances.
Right. So we, prior to this, may have had rhythms and patterns that worked for our whole collective unit. It worked for our partnerships. And stepping into this new terrain, what worked before when we had predictable patterns and routines and we could go into the office and we picked up our kids at 3, we need to assess what's really going on and redefine that of how are we going to get the domestic load done? What are the high priority work days and where are days that there can be a little bit more flexibility? How are we going to support each other in getting sleep? That this is a time when couples need to revisit their rules and their agreements and find something that serves them both for right now.
Frances, we're glad you called. Thanks a lot. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. 801-585-9378. We received this from Greg, who writes, "This must be what it's like to have schizophrenia. I feel like there's no reality, only a dreamlike past where there was this routine and complaints and a rush to numbly do the next thing. I cannot make sense of it," he writes, "at all. I try to find positive distractions like photography and reading, but I know they're not a panacea. My kids," he says, "are resilient. They're age 29, 15, and 9, respectively. But I worry about the younger ones. How will this affect them years from now?" So talk a little bit about that part, how not just for Greg's youngest child there, how that's going to affect them, but is this going to sort of create a kind of trauma that we're going to need to pay attention to in the coming months and maybe years?
It can, absolutely. I think one of the things that can introduce or that can be traumatic, trauma is often defined as being in the eye of the beholder. And it largely comes in when you have no prior context for what is happening. So when he's speaking to this disorientation and not being able to get grounded, there is, like, we are seeing people have these traumatic responses. And the challenge of this is you can't, when you're experiencing a trauma, you can't, you typically fight or flee. And we can't, I think a lot of us feel helpless to do something. and we can't really escape it. And so there's a little bit of this disorientation of then what do we do, and feeling hopeless and helpless in that. And that can be a traumatic response, which again is normal to these circumstances. We can't downplay the reality of what is happening to our psyche.
One of the things you've talked about is that it's helpful to reframe how we're thinking about anxiety. Would you talk a little bit about that? Like, what are the signs to be looking for? One of the things you've mentioned is we should name it. Like, not just – I have to say, this is one of the things my wife reminded me of the other day. She's like, if you're going through some stress, which I kind of was feeling, she said, talk to me about it. Like, so naming it, mm-hmm. saying it out loud, that's important.
It's very important because right now, again, no one is exempt and we can experience this in waves, but naming it can normalize it. It goes back to this idea of being interdependent and that we need each other. We need that help. And so when someone reaches out of talk to me, that's that social support that is beneficial for everybody. What anxiety, I think we can have this idea that anxiety looks one way, that it looks like this chronic and persistent worrying. However, it can look like anger. It can look like irritation. It can look like fatigue and brain fog. And so if we look at the amount of anxiety that we're all holding on the day-to-day and we're wondering, why am I so irritated? Or something that we could have absorbed, like an interaction with our child, why are we responding so strongly? That can be because we are already stretched with this anxiety that any additional load can cause us to snap or respond in ways that we're not used to or that would be atypical prior to this occurring. And so rethinking what anxiety looks like, naming it, giving ourselves room to be feeling anxious, again, another appropriate response. We are in unstable territory that currently isn't predictable. We're getting some milestones of possibly when schools can reopen and when we might be resumed, but there's nothing certain.
One of the things we're hearing about during all of this is an increase in domestic violence cases. The Salt Lake Police Department released this statement this week that there have been, I think it was a 33% increase in domestic violence-related calls over the past 2 weeks. What's going on there as far as you can tell? What accounts for all of that?
Right, and that was something that became really heavy for me in my heart of already looking at the marital strain that was existing in relationships and then having circumstances like this really adding to that where people could get out of their homes, go to work, have different places of refuge or safety. And what they're seeing is that people in homes where they're experiencing domestic violence, that the perpetrator is using this as a place to exert power, is a place to exert fear and terror and control, and that they're having a difficulty where someone could, again, leave their home and go seek refuge. There are instances where people are saying, if you leave your home, you're not going to be able to come back in because you'll now have the virus. And so I think there were already these problems, and they're being heightened.
So in some ways, I guess it could be said that the problems that already existed – not just in domestic violence cases, but in all cases, they're being exacerbated by this lack of certainty and instability right now.
Yes. In most marriages, like, you know, going back to when we're saying, well, start to establish your new rules and agreements, in marriages where there is already communication strain, there is already difficulty around talking about things, now needing to figure out agreements where maybe the balance of how things were done in the home was already a strain, this can enhance that. Or if you're not used to talking, jumping in a time of crisis, that's a elevated skill set that is now being placed onto the demands of these marriages.
801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation, 801-585-9378. Let's go back to the phones. George is with us in Salt Lake City. George, welcome.
How are you, Doug? How are you doing? Congratulations for your program. It's just incredible.
Thank you.
My comment, you know, was about what happened with me, you know, and my personal thing. I'm alone. I live on myself with somebody, a roommate here. But what happened is that I'm totally frustrated, you know, because people is calling me a lot, friends I haven't seen for years. They call me, they want to know what is my opinion about, you know, because I used to be a reporter for one of the magazines here in Utah for 17 years, but I investigate a lot. So that thing, you know, is positive. The people is, you know, being at home, your children are calling you, you know, everybody's trying to make a connection at this moment because almost, you know, we cannot go to work. We're totally isolated, you know, no work, nothing. So those are important things. But also somebody need to, of course, find exactly the truth because people want to know the truth. Yeah. And that, you know, will give you like a piece, a hope, exactly what's going on. There's so many different doctors talking. You know, I work with this pathology for almost 18 years. Still, I'm doing part time. And then another one is very famous in the world. You know, the United Nations, he have worked too. But they say a different story about it, the way we need to take care of this.
So but two things there, George, let me, and Kristen, let me get you to respond. So two things going on there. One, George is seeing the positive part of, I guess a lot are saying, a lot of people are saying this too, like we're hearing from people we hadn't heard from a long time. That's a good thing. That's one of those positive things. But also he mentions that it's hard, it can be confusing as he's sort of digesting all of the news that's coming out there. And if you're on Facebook or you're on the internet, you can sort of go into these rabbit holes. And that's got to be disconcerting because you're seeing conflicting stories, you're seeing conspiracy theories. What do you make of that part of this? And what kind of advice do you give to people who may be news junkies in the first place? I mean, could this just drive you nuts if you just go too far down these rabbit holes?
Yes, because you are. You are getting conflicting opinions, and but you're also getting people providing information from the context and with the, where they are, whether it's context of their location, context of their profession, context of the day. I mean, we're seeing new news and information roll out sometimes hourly. And so that can be really hard of what's the most current. And again, going back to anxiety, we can start to become hyper-vigilant about the news and checking and refreshing our screens to see what is the latest and who's saying what. This can be an important time to set parameters and boundaries around our media consumption, to curate our news feeds, to identify boundaries of I can check the news once a day, or I'm going to check it not at the end of the night because then my mind races if I read something, or I'm not going to read something first thing when I wake up.
Yeah.
Identifying that, because it is true, we are going to continue to get rolling information and conflicting information. And so we have to find these boundaries around news and information.
Say something before we head into a break about George's first comment, the idea that he's hearing from all kinds of people. That's an upside, right? That's good.
I think that's an upside. I think we are seeing people just like you had. I heard kids going over and playing the violin for birthdays. I don't know if I've seen that ever in the history of kids going over and doing this. So I think we are seeing a real positive side in that regard.
Let's go back to the phones. Vanessa is with us in St. George. Vanessa, hi.
Hi, Doug.
Go ahead.
I have been working from home for the last week, and it's been feeling quite isolating, actually. My wife still is going to work because her place of work is like a medical facility categorized. So she's still going, but I'm here at home, and the only connection I feel like I get with outside is when I take my dog out front and see the neighbors walk by. So,
well, Kristen Hudson, talk a little bit about that, if you would, because it seems like that's what a lot of us are trying to do, is like go for a walk, some way of trying to find some contact. I guess be creative is the advice you're giving people. Find ways to be responsibly sociable, I guess.
Yeah, you know, and I think she really speaks to that our patterns and routines that are often blanketed with social moments have been really disrupted. So something that was a very everyday part of our life, such as going into work, we're realizing just the little boosts of social connection we had that were woven into our everyday. So this might be a time when, as we're experiencing isolation or these feelings of isolation, that we need to not lean into maybe what we want to do, which is sink further into our couch or be alone, but to be intentional of getting outside, making a phone call, using technology to FaceTime, to send a text to someone and ask them how they're doing, which might start a conversation. That needs to be a much more frequent thing, where before we didn't have to be intentional about it. Now we really have to be intentional, because the social moments aren't baked into our everyday.
Vanessa, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. So one of the things I wanted to ask you, what you thought, Kristen, about one of the things that we were talking with earlier with the professor from Brigham Young University. She was talking about how doing service, giving support, has stronger benefits than receiving support. So are you suggesting to people, as sort of a coping mechanism, go out and find a way to help? I mean, that could be a way to deal with this anxiety.
Absolutely. I think people are also craving something to do, that, again, that regained sense of control. Like, if I can do nothing, offering social support. I know people are dropping off groceries to elderly or immune compromised people. They're doing that on the regular. They're dropping off craft kits to neighbors where they know they've got little kids. Those can be things that can be within our control and can help us feel a sense of empowerment in really situations that feel very out of control.
One of the things that you've talked about is how, I think, how did you put it? I think you said mental endurance, that this is, we have to think about this as a marathon, not as a sprint, I guess.
Yeah, I think one of the things that happened is when this was unfolding, and a lot of us were given the directive of, okay, schools are going to be closed for 2 weeks and we'll be back on. And so the Monday that occurred, I think people went into this with a bit more of a sprinting mentality of, okay, we can do this. We can get through anything for 2 weeks. And that as information is unfolded and we're realizing the realities of juggling work and school and home and life, and then noticing the amount of fatigue, that really it's a time to adjust our pace, because we are seeing the need to social distance. Those dates are being pushed out further, and that being able to get so much done in a day probably isn't realistic or sustainable, that we genuinely can't just get by on the least amount of sleep possible, that we really do need sleep. So moving out of sprint of, we've got to get through this and we're going to go in full force every day, may need to really be dialed back to, what is a pace that I can endure that preserves my health, my wellness, and my family.
Another thing we were talking with earlier is this idea that it's hard to feel dependent, that it just kind of goes against our culture, that it's perceived as a weakness. The idea of being vulnerable, I guess, might be important in terms of working all this out.
Yeah, and I think you spoke to this in your question of, is this just too early for us to be really feeling the pains of loneliness? That I think there's stigma around feeling lonely. There's stigma around needing help and having to ask for it, that help is there if we want it. Like, sure, that's a nice thing. But the reality is we all need help. We all need each other, that we all need, we cannot do this alone. And that's an important shift we also need to be making. That's going to be part of the endurance mindset of, we can't carry all of this every single day on our own.
One of the questions that keeps coming up is, how do you communicate to your elderly parents who are not used to being cooped up? They're not getting the same kinds of social media feeds that maybe the rest of us are. Mm-hmm. They're maybe not complete. It's not that they're stupid. They understand what's going on, but they don't get what all the hubbub is about, at least in some cases. What are you recommending in terms of that conversation?
In some of those, I think it is best to really speak to what it would mean to you. So I've got older parents, and we've been having a lot of conversations, and really talking with them of what it would mean to me for them to stay put and to social distance, and that we will come up with all the creative ways to keep them where they are, dropping off at home hair dye kits,
so that they can just do that at home. But it is a unique time to have roles reversed a bit. But getting into a fact battle and trying to debate if this is real or not can often be fruitless. Moving into a place of, this is what it would mean to me if you would really follow the guidelines. This is what it would do to help manage my own anxiety and my own worry. Please let me help you, and please stay put.
What do you think this has revealed about us as a, you know, as a species, I guess, as a community? One of the things you had mentioned earlier to us before was, and I loved this kind of metaphor, this image about how geese fly in a V. There's something important in that image for you.
Yeah, I really love the geese. I think so many of us can just get into our little routines and move through life alone in thinking we don't really need people. We like people, we want people, but we don't need them. When you look at the formation of geese, oftentimes what happens is you have a lead goose that will take on the flight. And then as they get tired, they go to the back of the formation and a new lead goose goes up front. And I think what we're seeing is, one, that emotions are real, that is a very human part of life, just like connecting is. The fact that we feel and have a dynamic range of emotions is a very human experience, that we can empathize and connect with each other in these emotions. Most of us are feeling this way, which is where we can move from loneliness to connection, because we're not the only ones feeling these things. I'm watching people be very generous and with their offerings from their skill set, reading books online and making offerings, and just an overall resiliency and a collaborative effort at a global level, which is really inspiring, of all of us trying to work towards a common goal.
So another reference to something we were talking about earlier is that idea that the professor was mentioning that there might be this danger after this pandemic passes for people to remain isolated. She described it as something like a social recession. And so I wanted to get your sense of that, because she's mentioning, and I think you've talked about this too, don't get out of the habit, like, and don't create bad habits. So how are you thinking about that part?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that when we come out of this, there's going to have to be trust restored. Trust takes time and allowing for that. And for a lot of us, we are going to really need to seek professional support in moving through the possible trauma and anxiety and grief that we experience. And that goes back to the intentionality of keep healthy habits of connection. They may look different now, but they're so important, and they're going to remain important after this as we restore our social connections in ways that are more in person.
Kristen, let me ask you one more question before we fully lose your phone line. One of the things you've asked is, or said anyway, is that you feel like there's this big fundamental shift that could happen. How is this going to change us in that way, do you think?
I think we're going to start. I think there's a major revisiting of our priorities, where we're spending our time. I'm seeing a lot of people looking at their calendars of what would have been done tomorrow or next week and going, how in the world did we get so much done in one day or one week? I know there's a lot of gratitude going on. And so I think those things are going to play out, and people are going to come out of this wondering if the career or work they're in is the right line for them, if where they're spending their time is the best use. And I think all of that's going to start to bubble up as this continues to unfold.
Kristen Hodson, she's the founder and executive director of The Healing Group, co-author of the book Real Intimacy, A Couple's Guide for Genuine Healthy Sexuality, joined us from her home in Salt Lake by phone, of course. Kristen, thank you very much for that.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to those of you who reached out. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ali Vallarta, Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.